Coming up on this episode.
You have to be able to take that legal pad out and draw a line down the middle of it. List all the things you're great at and all the things you're either not good at or you don't really like to do.
This is the show where we get personal with today's fast growth founders about their game-changing companies and the challenges they encountered on their path from founder to CEO. Welcome back to the show, my fellow founders around the world. I'm Todd Uderstadt, your guide on the trail from founder to CEO. And I'm very excited to introduce you to Marshall Chesrown. Marshall founded Rumble On in 2016 and has been leading the way as CEO ever since. Now, Rumble On is an online buyer and seller of vehicles that allows both consumers and dealers to buy, sell, and trade and finance pre-owned motorcycles in an efficient, fast, transparent, and engaging experience. With 64 on the team and growing, Rumble On is a publicly traded company that has achieved, get this now, 130% quarter-over-quarter growth rate, going from zero to 100 million in revenue in only 15 months. Gosh, that's as fast as some motorcycles, Marshall. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to talking with you because we talk to a lot of early stage founders, and you not only are not an early stage founder, but you are a very experienced founder in lots of different ways. And so we love to be able to tap into your wisdom to share with our founders around the world. But as you know, we start off with a powerful leadership quote, or maybe a mantra, something that has been a beacon lighting the way for you on your personal path from founder to CEO. So we kind of, I also ask you to sing it, rap it, or perform it, but something tells me you're not going to want to do that, right?
Yeah, no. However, before getting into the automobile business as a young kid, I was a professional musician. So
really?
If I was forced to, I probably could, but with that being said, I think that my very first, what I consider my mentor in the automobile business, who I started with at 17 years old, he had a quote that he used a lot, and I've lived by it and used it many, many times. And it's a very simple one, but I think it's a powerful one. And he used to say, early to bed, early to rise, work like hell and advertise. We try to, as a company, and I try to surround myself with people that live by that mantra, that there's a lot of things, maybe sometimes people can outsmart you, but always make sure that they can't outwork you. My mother was asking me the other day about, you know, how you doing working all these hours? Because I'm basically a, you know, 24/7 guy and always have been. And I said, well, I don't remember the last time I read about anybody that died from working too hard. So I think we'll be okay.
Don't you love when moms ask us questions like that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, my parents were educators and my only sister just retired as an educator. So, you know, I think the thing about me is that, you know, I'm sure you get the opportunity to talk to a lot of young startup type guys. Steve and I, we used to quote that this is an old man startup. And a nice part about being a part of an old man startup is if we've never been to that class that says you can build a business without a good, clear plan to profitability. So,
well, you know, I got to tell you, Marshall, a couple of weeks ago, I remember reading an article that came out and said, hey, the most successful founders are the ones who are over 45. Did you see that article floating around the internet?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I took great solace in that. Well, I really appreciate you being here. And I do think you're right. I mean, working hard not only increases the odds of luck, right? There's a famous quote around that, but it also increases the odds that you're finally going to get it right, because if you keep working hard and stay at it, there's the grit and the ability to be able to overcome all the obstacles, and you've overcome lots of obstacles, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But I think everyone wants to understand, first of all, what Rumble On is all about, because I personally love what you've done, and make you laugh, but when I was a kid, I didn't have a motorcycle, but I had a moped, an Indian moped, get back and forth to work. And it was very difficult to sell that thing after I bought it. And so,
yeah. Well, I think everybody's heard the old story about boats, you know, they're, or whatever, but boats are the one that usually get picked on the most. And I'd say that the happiest days of a boat owner's life is the day he buys it, the day he sells it. We're disrupting a very, very inefficient supply chain solution for consumers. 70% of all recreational vehicles, not just motorcycles, to 70% of them are being transacted in a peer-to-peer fashion, meaning just private party sales through the likes of Craigslist and different listing sites and so forth. It's very inefficient for a lot of reasons, but primarily if you're selling your friend your motorcycle, more than likely you don't want to finance him, and pretty sure you probably don't want to take his old motorcycle in on trade or his boat or whatever. So it's very, very inefficient. And it was interesting to us that unlike the automobile business, where dealers really dominate the pre-owned transaction space, people were really stuck. I mean, you drive down the highway and you see these big yards full of RVs and different things, and some of them sit there for years, years and years on end. And so from our perspective, the entire process was broken. And in other words, people understand that why these new retail ideas come out, which, you know, we also are obviously in the selling business, but those are pretty basic today, because to be online, you have to eliminate the risk. But in this particular case, they're actually selling to us. And our whole model revolves around that whole acquisition strategy, stepping in the middle of that peer-to-peer transaction and disrupting it.
I love that. Well, so but it's more than just motorcycles, as you pointed out. It's also RVs. Give us some other examples of things that are on the platform.
Yeah, I think the important thing to understand, our technology revolves around proprietary software. Everything we do revolves around aggregating data based on a VIN number. So we call it VIN explosion technology. So when we put in a VIN for anything into our system, we have instant access to all data sources, whether that be what's out there available for retail, whether that's a consumer that has it on Craigslist or a dealer that has it on CycleTrader or whatever it might be. And we also have all of the wholesale data with regards to what is sold at auction, like this particular bike. And it's all based on that VIN decoding into year, make, model. And then, of course, the customer gives us miles and condition and so forth. So that's the technology. So if you look forward of the, you know, the long-term objective of Rumble On, is it all revolves around anything that has a VIN number. We have a belief that there's a real opportunity to have a single place where people can go and buy, sell, trade, and finance anything. Down the road, we had boats, we had RVs, we had maybe cars and trucks and whatever, that you could go to a single place. And let's say you had a motorcycle, but now you're getting a little bit older and you got married and you have a kid, and now you would rather have a minivan for the wife and use the motorcycle. Well, it would be almost impossible for you to do that. And so we want to create a platform of anything that has a VIN, where you can do everything you want to do, whether it's buy, sell, trade, or finance.
That makes a lot of sense. So when we're talking about VIN numbers too, just out of curiosity, VIN numbers are also associated with the historical repair and all that kind of information about vehicles. Is that also insight and information that Rumble On provides to buyers and sellers?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one thing that has never been done with the new classified site that we're going to list. It's for private parties only. So we start off everything with a cash offer. That's the difference between us. There's a million places that you can go and get people's advice, right?
Right.
You can go to NADA, you go to all those places, but none of them write a check. Nope. So it's pure somebody's opinion based on some data feed, right?
Right.
What we do is we start off with a very friction-free transaction of wiring you the money when the asset is still sitting in your garage, and we have a complete trust factor with consumers. So you don't have to leave your living room to go to a showroom. You can do it right from your house.
Well, it sounds like you're eliminating the challenges of trust that typically plague that type of business model.
And if you think about it, it's really a culture change. People say, well, why wouldn't somebody just copy the business and do it the way you guys do it? Well, I'd have to ask you the same thing. Well, why haven't car dealers done what CarMax does? It's a cultural change. I mean, there's nobody in our business. We don't have salespeople. We don't have sales managers. We don't negotiate. We know that everything that we price is priced at the best value in the marketplace. We remove all that friction and all that stuff because you have to really to be effective online. But we don't have anybody in the entire building that gets a commission. So if you think about that in relationship to traditional sales, and I'm not talking bad about them. I was a dealer for a long, long time, and I've been doing it for 40 years. I'm a huge supporter of the dealer community and why they do, and there's certainly a place for it. But to add an element of negotiating, as an example, to an online seller would not be scalable.
Yeah.
And so you have to break through that trust barrier in a very, very untrusted industry. And what drives that trust is primarily commission pay plans. When everybody on your staff gets paid on an eat what you kill pay plan, it creates a culture and a behavior that causes the discomfort for consumers.
Yeah. It sure does. Well, because you're not necessarily looking out for your customer. You're looking out for yourself. And that's always back in someone's mind.
Well, it has to be. If you think about it, in a traditional dealership format, everybody is paid basically commission. There's not hourly rates, right? And so how do they make more money, which is what everybody wants to do in life, right?
Right.
They need to extract as much as they possibly can. But every single person you interact with is on that same type of mission, right? And so that's what creates, in my estimation, the distrust.
And well, clearly it's taking off. But you didn't just start off here. You didn't, as you mentioned before, you have a lot of experience in the industry. But you most recently launched a company called Vroom.
Kevin Westfall and I founded the company. We set out to do that in 2013. And our objective and what we originally said in our very first raise was that we wanted to build a $250 million company in 3 years. Well, in 2 years, it went over $1 billion in a hurry. And when you grow that fast, you have a significant need for capital. And along the way, we had the opportunity to add some great private equity partners in Catterton and T. Rowe Price and General Catalyst and so forth. And, you know, one thing led to another. And then along came the opportunity for the board to bring on Paul Hennessy, who came over from Priceline, Priceline being, I think, the second largest online seller in the world. Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity, for sure, a startup, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think, you know, when people ask me about it, obviously I still have an investment there and have a lot of respect for all the people involved, whether investors or management.
So how would you characterize leaving Vroom?
I think it's the simple version would be with the addition of Paul and others. You know, the company just grew huge. We ended up basing operations in New York. And I guess the honest answer would be probably too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And so so I decided to go off on other ventures and on very, very good terms. I had a consulting agreement with them for the first couple of years, et cetera. So there was no issue, and there still isn't today, never would be. But it was a great learning experience because we started that on the back of an envelope. And when we started Rumble On, we didn't have to go through some of the same growth trajectory of making mistakes. Because no matter what you do in a total new startup, you're going to have some bumps in the road. And so Absolutely. We were eliminate those, grow this company significantly faster, take advantage of the things that we saw that were a huge opportunity, which is primarily is the willingness of a consumer to sell to us online. Buying online is just, you know, again, that's getting kind of basic blocking and tackling, remove all the friction, remove the risk to the consumer, and they'll buy from you as long as your price is right and your product is well represented. And I started looking at other opportunities from what we had learned in the Vroom experience, and I landed on RVs to start because I saw a lot of the same dynamics with dealers and consumers and all those kinds of things. But when I dug a little deeper and saw that there really wasn't a big representation of dealers participating in pre-owned, quite honestly, I was amazed. I mean, if you think about car dealers today, I don't care if you're selling Fiats or Ferraris, you better be in the pre-owned business or you probably don't make a lot of money.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge part to the profitability of a dealership today. A recreational vehicle from a motorcycle to a bus motorhome can have anywhere from 25 to 40% margin. And I don't think a lot of consumers, you know, realize that. And it's because it didn't have a big online presence. And so we wanted to change that. And I think we've done that.
Well, absolutely. And you are, I think, disrupting a marketplace that was ripe for it. And it's about time because it's very difficult to sell these things. I mean, think about the number of people who like meet in parking lots to sell their RV and their motorcycle and all those types of things that... in fact, I know local police departments make a little spot in their parking lot because those are also risky situations. And you help to eliminate, I think, a lot of that risk, but you add a lot of value in doing so as well.
If you think about the process itself, it's kind of a scary endeavor. You bought it in 2009. It's got 2,000 miles on it. You know, your wife's hanging laundry on it. You haven't licensed it. Nobody goes out and buys a motorcycle because they need one. But typically, it's a want, not a need, right? A car and a truck is a need. You need it. But these are a different type of purchase. And it's the same thing with RVs and so forth. And so once you get to the point that you've had it sitting in the garage and you want to move it, the number one listing, just use motorcycles as an example, the number one listing site is Craigslist. That in itself leads to an opportunity for disruption because if you think about the average person, do you really want total strangers calling you, emailing you, coming to your house, wanting to ride the motorcycle? And then even the simple things like, where do I sign the title? Or I've got to pay off. How do I pay it off? The guy's not going to want to pay me until I've paid it off. I don't have the money to pay it off. I need his money to pay. I mean, like I said, it's totally inefficient. It just flat doesn't work. And that's what disruption of industries is all about.
In fact, I listen to Dave Ramsey on the radio sometimes, and there's a lot of people that call in, and he tells them, well, you need to sell your vehicle or sell your motorcycle or whatever to get out of debt. And their next question then is, well, how do I go about doing that? Because many of them haven't done that, especially if they're upside down on their debt for it. You know, he even doesn't do a very good job of describing it because it's different in different states too. There's lots of issues when you're trying to sell these types of things. And I think people's go-to thing is Craigslist prior to Rumble On to be able to help facilitate that.
Right, exactly.
Well, your passion for the individual trying to make these transactions, your enthusiasm for really adding value is very contagious to me, and I know to all of our listeners. And I know it comes from a deep well of experience. And one of the things that some people may not know about you is that you also had some challenging time periods in your career. You had a bankruptcy that really kind of taught you a lot, right?
Right. I ended up getting in the real estate business in a very big way, and I turned about $100 million net worth into several $100 million net worth, shooting for $1 billion. I've owned restaurants. I built the best new private golf course in America that opened in 2003. I owned a NASCAR team for 11 years. I owned Colorado National Speedway. I have done a bunch of different stuff. And, you know, everything I touched seemed turned to gold. So along came 2008. I had these 41 entities. I had close to $1 billion worth of real estate, all my eggs basically in one basket, but we were just printing money. And along came the lending crisis. And we had about $220 million worth of debt on about $800 million worth of assets, which was very conservative.
Yeah, I would say that conservative.
We were doing all kinds. We were doing mixed use. We were doing everything from condos to land development, private golf courses, so on and so forth. And everything stopped in the banking industry. And the ability to refinance short-term real estate loans basically is what caused the debacle. I've spent about 4.5 years working through all the issues with all the lenders, still have great relationships with them, still do business with a bunch of them. But after 4.5 years, we whittled that down to a very small number in size to everything else, fairly unscathed. And I knew I wanted to move forward with another business. The real bottom line is never, never, never personally guarantee corporate debt. You know, personal guarantee your personal debt, that's one thing. But right. Again, my excuse is that I had 40 years of history and I'd always personally guaranteed everything. And I'd never had a business that didn't pan out. So it was never even an issue when asked. Yep. But in all reality, I probably never needed to sign any of those. If I would have just said no, they would have still loaned the companies the money. We were a successful company. We made a lot of money. But when the music stops and there's personal guarantees attached to corporate debt, but after spending millions of dollars of attorney's fees and everything else, and I knew I wanted to start over, I made the decision to do it. I was never concerned about whether I could make it back, and certainly, you know, have proven that that's something to do. So, you know, I don't look back on it as a negative. It was certainly a great learning experience, but two things learned, right? Never put all your eggs in one basket. Never make the assumption that just because you're dealing with wealthy people that, you know, that they don't have the same, because what happened with these banks is it wasn't that they didn't want to make new loans to, you know, let's say it was a 2-year loan that was coming due. They couldn't. They had the feds scrutinizing them and all the new laws and all the things, and everybody was scared to death, and appraisers wouldn't appraise match values, and on and on and on. So I won't bore you with all the gory details, but I think I ended up with a lot of respect from a lot of people because I spent 4.5 years working through all of that with no benefit to myself, down to just the last few. I think some of them felt that they would outweigh the situation. I think most of there was only about 3 left. And I think they looked at it and said, this guy's probably going to come back. So I think I'll wait. And I didn't want to put my future at risk for a past bad decision. So that's how that went down. That certainly would never happen again. And we're marching ahead in a big way.
Well, Marshall, you just bring so much knowledge and wisdom from all these experiences to many founders. And that situation, just hearing you say, hey, I wasn't going to give up, right? I mean, you were going to give up. You weren't going to let it deter you. And you went on to founding other companies, obviously most recently Rumble On. And, you know, you mentioned a couple of things that I heard you say about learnings. One is, obviously, don't personally guarantee corporate debt. That's a big one. And you also mentioned before, I kind of caught this when you said, when moving from Vroom to Rumble On, there were maybe some too many cooks and you kind of wanted to be in charge. You strike me as someone who likes to lead. You strike me as someone who likes to build. So on these many journeys that you've had from founder to CEO, has there been one very big lesson that you learned about yourself as a leader that along the way you said, gosh, you know what? This is me. I'm going to deal with me this way because I'm not going to worry about changing this element of myself, because clearly you're a high achieving kind of guy, right? Clearly obstacles are just opportunities for you. But what have you learned about yourself as a leader?
My operating style is this. I think where a lot of people, especially young people, you know, until they get more experience, you tend to surround yourself with people that like and think the same things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to surround myself with and always have is OCD people. Okay, you can't have too many of them. But, you know, I like to laugh with our staff. You know, I tell them I feel some days that I need to have a striped shirt and a whistle on, right? Because you've got really, really high energy people that are running 9-0 all the time. And there's a lot of collisions when there's that much traffic in the air, right? But I think as an entrepreneur and as a CEO, you have to be honest with yourself. You don't have to share it with everybody, but you have to be able, my old boss taught me this years and years ago, you have to be able to take that legal pad out and draw a line down the middle of it and list all the things you're great at and all the things you're either not good at or you don't really like to do.
Mm.
And but he did have an interesting concept too. He said, if there's more stuff on the left than on the right, you need to start over because nobody has that balance. But the point is then when you go to surround yourself with the people that are going to have to help you through this march, make sure that they're good at all those things that you either don't like or you're not really good at.
So name one of them for us, Marshall.
And I don't need five people around here that know how to do what I know how to do, yeah. Right? I need people that think in a whole different way. So our whole team, you know, I'm definitely the old guy in the building. You know, this is all, if you talk about these internet companies, I mean, I think the average age here is probably, you know, in the maybe mid to late 20s, which is all great. I love it. I certainly don't feel 60, but it helps you not age too. But the only other thing that if you were to interview all of our people, it's kind of twofold. Number one, I tell everybody, I don't care if you guys like each other, but I want to make sure we all respect each other, right? And have a respect for what we know and what we know how to do. But my job, from my perspective, and why I think we continue to be successful, is I push everybody to the edge of the cliff every minute of every day.
Mm.
I want everybody's toes on the edge of that cliff. I just want to make sure that I don't push them over. And so
or they don't fall over themselves too, right?
Well, sometimes they do. I mean, we have very, very little turnover. Probably 25% of the staff that is here have worked with me or for me for years and years.
Mm.
And I like surrounding myself with that. I call it nepotism, even though they're not actually family. They're like family, right? Because we spend more time at work than we do at home. And so if somebody's been with you for 25 years, they're family.
Right.
And I like to surround myself with people because I don't have to go through any learning curve. I know what they're capable of, and I think it's a better way to work. But this whole concept of, you know, a lot are afraid I might be pushing too hard. And I kind of learned some of this from Wayne Huizenga, which, you know, Wayne is just, you know, he was on the cover of about every magazine back in the day. He did Blockbuster Video. He did AutoNation. He founded Waste Management. I mean, started with the garbage truck in South Florida. So he was a really interesting guy to listen to. And he had a philosophy. Let's say you're talking about a facility that you're going to build. Your people are going to think 10 to 20 acres is what we need, right? It takes a guy like Wayne Huizenga that says, you know, maybe we ought to think about 200, right? And take people completely out of their comfort zone and push them to think so much bigger than they ever thought they could think. Paul Hennessy had a great thing. And Paul's the CEO of Vroom. And I listened to him introduce himself to the staff when he came on board. And he had an interesting analogy. And I'm paraphrasing, so, you know, excuse if I don't say it exactly. But he said an interesting thing. He said, you know, when he started in business, he said, we used to take 6 months to dream things up, 6 months to build them, and 6 months to test them. He says, today, you have to think of them today, build them tomorrow, test them the following day, and if it doesn't work by noon, start over.
Yep, that's right.
Because everything is moving so fast. And so just because you had success in maybe your previous venture and you did it that way, in today's world, you better speed it up by tenfold.
Well, you mentioned before about, you know, surrounding yourself with this great team of people. And you mentioned this list on the left-hand side, the strengths, and the right-hand side. I don't know if you call them limitations, but, you know, the challenges you have. How have you offset one of the right-hand side of that piece of paper, a limitation, something that you're not quite good at? Give us an example of what you've done to overcome something on that right-hand side of your list.
The simplest one for people to understand is the dynamics of technology, right? I understand what is broken in a process, mm-hmm. right? And what is wrong with the customer experience? I've been dealing with customers for, you know, over 40 years. And so I think I have a really good understanding of that. So I understand what needs to be done, but that road, that bridge between the vision and the execution has to be the people that I hire mm-hmm. because I have no, when we talk, you know, we talk a lot of words and there's a lot of acronyms now and all these different things, but, you know, in all reality, you know, it's coding and it's all this stuff. I walked into a meeting the other day and they had a wall of coding they were reviewing on the new app that we just launched a week ago. And I mean, this was Chinese to me.
Hmm.
So, you know, the way that the world has evolved for someone my age that, you know, grew up with the education that I had, et cetera, you've got to surround yourself with people that have a whole different skill set, right? A whole different understanding. Now, do they know how to structure it, envision it, and execute? They're part of the execution, right? But the execution strategy and all that stuff is still what I love to do. You said, mentioned a builder. I'm much more passionate about thinking of things and building things and getting them over the finish line than operating them on a day-to-day basis. Mm. That's not where the excitement comes from. The excitement comes from new opportunities.
So what I heard you say is, hey, listen, I just happen to have a knowledge gap in the most current technology, being able to do coding and whatnot. So what have you done team-wise? Like, how do you compensate for the fact that you may not necessarily understand all the tech elements of it, but be able to communicate to your team and translate what you envision into their minds? How does that work in a very practical manner for you and your team?
Well, we had a clear understanding of what the long-term vision of the company was, right? This is what's broken.
Right.
And everything we do revolves around the customer. I've said to everybody, anytime someone asks me about, you know, I'm starting this business and I'm thinking about doing this, and, you know, what's your advice in that regard? I said, always operate your business that the customer is the judge and jury of the success of your idea, not your staff, not your people. And so what I mean by that is, if you go out today on Rumble On and if you see the millions of people that have visited our website, if you put in "sell my Harley" into your browser today, we come up at number one, right? Those are all things that I've got to have people around that totally understand. They understand the challenge, right? But they also understand the value of that in both the short term and in the long term.
Yeah.
You know, like organic search is an example. As big as that is in people's life today, every time you add to your strength on Google or on Facebook, you are making what they call the moat wider and deeper, right? Because somebody can come in after you and try to compete. But those are mountains that are really, really hard and really expensive to overcome.
Right.
So that's why you have to move so fast. The second thing is, make sure you've got a clear path to profitability. Because when people are going to invest in you and invest in a company, they'll invest in the idea, but I don't believe they should, nor do very many smart ones invest unless the right management's in place. They invest in the people that can execute the idea, not necessarily always the idea. And at some point, you've got to be able to walk investors intelligently through a path to profitability with your model. So many people today come up with great ideas, but at the end of the day, I don't want to invest because, number one, you don't have a lot of experience in that regard. You got a great idea.
Right.
Okay. Number two, I asked you three times to walk me to profitability and you can't get me there.
You know, as I'm listening to you tell your story, Marshall, it strikes me that there are three key things that have probably been the secret to your personal success as a founder and CEO. The first is absolutely clear vision. Like, you are so clear, unadulterated, unambiguous, clear about what the vision is and how it impacts the customer. And almost every business, it sounds like, you've been involved in, including Rumble On now. The second thing is that you seem to be laser beam focused on what needs to get done. And my guess is that because you're also really good at building a team and attracting people, that the hiring and building that team, those three things, the vision, the focus, and keeping the team that you hired focused, is probably the secret sauce to your success and helps to probably overcome that knowledge gap when it comes to the very specifics around tech.
I think it's true, because I think if you go back, and number one, I appreciate it, it's very kind thoughts, but even if you go way back and in my starting in the automotive career, I didn't know parts, as an example. That's right. I started off as a salesperson, right?
Yeah.
And then I became a finance guy and I didn't know anything about parts. Well, why was my first store that I bought so successful? Because the first guy that I hired was the best parts guy I could find, right? I don't know the business. It looks scary to me. It's small margins and, you know, things I could see, you know, financially.
Right.
And I went out and I hired a great parts guy. And so it's always been the same sauce, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just the playing field changes. And the consumers are deciding what changes. The cab company couldn't do anything to stop Uber. Mm. I mean, I haven't physically been in a cab since I could download the Uber app, right? So, I mean, you can do it, but you got to do it big and you got to do it quick and you got to have clear direction and you've got to push your people absolutely to the limit all the time.
Well, Marshall, it is your passion, I think, that is a secret sauce to your success, along with that vision and that focus and the hiring. And I can't thank you enough for sharing all your passion and your history and all your wisdom with our founders around the world. If there was one piece of advice that Marshall, the CEO, would tell Marshall, the founder, about building an amazing team, what would Marshall, the CEO, tell Marshall, the founder?
I think problems in business always, whether it's a consumer issue, whether it's an employee issue or whatever, it is about communicating. And you have to be willing to address the negatives and make them a positive really, really fast. Don't let things sit out there and marinate. They don't get better. I always tell everybody, bad news does not get better with time. It isn't like wine, right? And so if you've got something, it might be small to you, might be big to them, or vice versa, but address it up front. And the other thing that we do is we never do things in front of others, right? I have an open door policy with all my people. And I say, you can come in here and you can say anything you want to me, any way you want to say it. You want to swear, you want to do whatever, doors open, you absolutely can do that. But let's make sure we have the same level of professionalism and respect when I have the opportunity to talk to you about things that maybe aren't perfect in my world.
Right.
Again, it goes back to the same thing. It goes back about creating that respect with these people, because the point is that when they come to work, they want to be there. And people, I think, inherently want to be led. They want a leader that makes decisions. If they make bad decisions, they fix them. And they don't make excuses. And they don't let the people around them make the excuses. So long answer to your question, but I think it's, you know, directing the band. And from a musician background, I have used that cliche, but that's really what you are. I mean, you're directing the band, and you've got to get everybody singing the same hymn book at the same time, the same way. And, you know, that's the challenge.
Well, it's amazing advice and great wisdom. And I know all of us are going to keep watching Rumble on, and continue to do a great job for so many people and also do well in the markets. And if our listeners want to learn more about Rumble On and also maybe connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
We're very accessible. You can go on our website. You can see where our contact is. If you reach out to us, we're happy to discuss. As long as I don't have the opportunity to talk to everybody that wants to redo my website, but outside of that, I'll talk to about anybody.
I can imagine that you do, and we're grateful for you sharing your wisdom. We hope that you and your team at Rumble On continue to be successful.
Thanks, Bud. Best of luck. Thank you.
Hey, it's Todd again. I hope you took away some value out of this interview. And don't forget, you don't have to go it alone on your journey from founder to CEO. Check out Trail Team 10, our exclusive group dedicated to helping founders like you on your path to CEO. New trail teams are forming now, so head on over to trailteam10.com and fill out our fast and easy application. In the meantime, remember, when you grow, your business grows.